This is episode 24 of the Nothing Human podcast, Nothing Human Conversations, Three Powers Recap with Krista, part three.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.
Welcome to the Nothing Human podcast. I am Michael Minkoff, and I want to explore the big human questions with you, such ways to make complex ideas more accessible to anyone and everyone. All I need from you is curiosity and attention. And join me on this journey of discovery, and I think that you will find that there's nothing about the big T truth that we can't understand better together. All right, all the episodes for Nothing Human and my bonus podcast, Being Something Extra, are available on my website, nothinghumanpodcast.com. If you have any questions or comments, please comment on the relevant episode on my website, and I will make sure to respond either there or in a podcast. If you want to support me in my work, which I would really appreciate, please rate and review this podcast wherever you're listening to it. And if you want to support me even further than that, you can become my patron for as little as $5 a month on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes on my website. Thank you all very much for your support. I want to say there's some behind-the-scenes posts that I make there on Patreon every month, but I'm also starting to dump a lot more material on there, including conversations like this one. This will be the last of three parts to the conversation I had with my sister Krista. And there was more that we could talk about, and we probably will record that. But I will be posting a lot of those kinds of conversations to my Patreon from here on out. And I also wanted to let you all know that I am going to do a live stream on my YouTube channel every other Wednesday starting October 8th. I can put a link in the show notes. But you can go and you can join me. You can ask questions through the chat. And I'm going to try and make that happen every other Wednesday and for the foreseeable future. So if you want to join me there, that would be awesome. I'd really appreciate it. Otherwise, you can check out those conversations and others like them either on my Patreon or on my YouTube channel. I'll have to figure out where I'm going to place all of this material. But I've been recording a lot of material, conversations with people. And if you're interested in hearing those conversations, I'm going to be posting them to my Patreon at least, and a few of them on YouTube. And do join me on my live stream. That's coming up on Wednesday, October 8th. So basically like a week from now. So stay tuned for that, and now let's get into it.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien.
We're back.
Oh, hey.
Hey. All right. So you had a couple more questions.
I do. So in episode 8, you talk about Ruth Benedict's book, The Chrysanthemum and the Sword, which popularized the theories behind anthropological or cultural distinctions, the categories of honor / shame, innocence / guilt, and power / fear. It was suggested that the Western culture, and I'm assuming we're speaking of North America when we're talking about the Western culture.
It's like all the inheritors of the Greco-Roman tradition.
Okay.
So some of that is European as well. Continental Europe, UK.
You state, or she states, that they use innocence as guilt as a part of its cultural distinction. From my perspective, it seems like that the West is more of a power-fear dynamic. But, I mean, I'm not probably thinking correctly on that. Can you do a little more explaining?
Yeah. So I basically said I think that she's organizing them in terms of their relationship to the will. So honor, shame, innocence, guilt, and fear, power are all three actually will. They're distinctions of the will. But they're distinctions of the will when viewed through the lens of the primary power. And when I talk about the West putting intellect as the primary power, as it should be, like you're thinking, you know, Plato, right? So philosopher king, and then underneath that you have the honor driven, you know, the will oriented, the order keepers. And then underneath that you have, you know, your merchants and your the masses, the unwashed masses who are just, they're just interested in their appetites, right? Which he, you know, that would be the affections in Plato's mind. Because again, Aquinas is kind of drawing from all of that. And he has a kind of similar perspective, although Aquinas is still in a society where he's recognizing maybe the will is more important. But he even has a discussion of whether the intellect, whether the, because he even says the will is part of the intellect, right? Mm. So the will is allowed to be part of the intellectual like world. Mm. And so in those terms, he is kind of elevating the will a little bit more than maybe Plato does. But Plato's a philosopher, so of course he's not going to elevate the will over the intellect. But when you think, most people do not function this way. Most people, even in Western society, are not intellect first. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of human beings on the planet, I think, are will-oriented. They're thinking about what is good to do, mm-hmm. right? Like they're trying to figure out what's the right decision, you know, how do I practically live my life? What are rules for my life that make sense? So given that fact that most people are volitional, and then maybe if you, you know, include women in the most people, which I would,
I
would say most women are actually affectional. Mm-hmm. There are definitely volitional women, and there are even intellect first women. I would say intellect first women are even more rare than intellect first men, and intellect first men are pretty rare. Mm-hmm. So we're talking intellect first women. Those are the weirdest of the weird. Mm-hmm. And they exist. They do exist, mm-hmm. but that's a very small percentage of the population as a whole. And it's even a small percentage of the population of intellect first mm-hmm. people. Okay. So, and again, people are like, oh, there's all sorts of academics. Well, I've already said, I don't think most academics are actually intellect first. Mm-hmm. I think they're usually intellect second. That most academics are actually will first, intellect second. If they are intellect first, they're intellect external, mm-hmm. right? So they have external standards in the sense of they're adopting or drawing from things that have already been established.
Right.
When you look at most academic writing, it's pretty obvious that's the case because they're mostly quoting from other people's writings. They're mostly synthesizing other ideas that have already been made. You know, I mean, they're reacting to.
They're not like new thoughts, new ideas.
Right. They're not necessarily contributing a huge amount in terms of original material.
Right.
And so in that case, you know, even most intellect first people are external. Okay. So anyway, given that fact, if you're an anthropologist or a sociologist and you're studying peoples mm-hmm. in general terms, mm-hmm. it's like, well, what are you really going to be like zooming in on? Probably the will. Because the vast majority of those people are operating according to the will. What is the best way of life, right? Mm-hmm. Like the best thing, but the best choice-making structures that we have, right? Mm. Different societies have different ways of making choices with, and what are good choices, what are bad choices, you know, what are right choices, what are wrong choices. And, but they have a different standard, right? A different idea of like, what makes a choice right, mm-hmm. right? So if you go to an honor shame culture, they're going to say that honor and shame are what determine whether or not a choice is right. So right. If it goes towards honor, then it is a right choice. If mm-hmm. it goes towards shame, that's the wrong choice, right? Mm-hmm. And if you go to a culture, but it's still oriented around the will, and innocence, guilt is the same way. If I'm pursuing my standing, right, my name, my status,
right,
then that's an intellectually oriented assessment of my will position, okay. right? How do I determine whether or not my choices give me a status of innocence or a status of guilt? That is more of like a position of name, right? Mm-hmm. So it's more intellectually flavored, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. And so I would say the West being more intellectually flavored in terms of what it considers to be what is the right primary faculty, right, mm-hmm. primary power, is going to be more oriented towards innocence and guilt, because innocence and guilt is the intellectual flavoring of that will-oriented culture. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah, I think I'm tracking.
And in the affectional-oriented or affectionally attuned cultures, fear and power typically is what is the standard you would use to determine right or wrong choices. Because the affections are saying, hey, what gives me good? Or what could potentially hurt me? Mm-hmm. So power would be the way in which you acquire good. Mm-hmm. And fear is, you know, like I'm afraid of these bad things happening. And so, but it's still will in the sense of obviously like power is the temptation of the will.
But it's the temptation of the will, particularly when it's affectionately attuned, right?
Okay.
Because power is a way that we protect ourselves from harm or pursue good for ourselves. And so in affectionately tuned cultures, they tend to be more fear power. Okay, so ultimately, though, any will-oriented person, like in terms of what we've talked about throughout the podcast and stuff, any will-oriented person is going to be tempted toward power, because power is the way that you accomplish your will.
Right.
But in terms of the chrysanthemum and sword, or, you know, anthropological categories, if your culture as a culture says power is most important, fear is the thing we hate, I don't want to be in a state of fear, I want to be in a state of power, it's more than likely because they're affectionally oriented. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, the power is not so much accomplishing their will. Yeah. That's not what they're looking for first and foremost. Accomplishing their will is toward the purpose of good, meaning that I could be secure and happy and have enough food and et cetera. And that I could, you know, benefit those people who are in my family or in my tribe or in my whatever. And I need power in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So the seeking for power is not so much because my will is right and should be accomplished. That's actually more the honor shame cultures, and even the innocence guilt cultures that tend to use power in those purposes.
Okay.
If you're talking about pure fear versus pure power, generally speaking, that's like global South, African, you know, Latin American, these kinds of things, where there's this idea oftentimes, like a lot of these cultures are very much affected by the idea of animism, that there are spirits. Some of them are bad spirits, some of them are good spirits. And so that there's like kind of danger all around in the spiritual realm.
Mm-hmm.
And there's powers all around that I have to contend with. Mm-hmm. Like that's sort of where that comes from. That's where that idea kind of has so much. That's why there's so much stock for those kinds of ideas in those cultures, is that if I don't appease the spirit, you know, who's going to try and put a blight on my harvest, then I might not be able to feed myself, or my community might starve, you know, next season. So I need to make sure that that power is resisted. So there's this fear that's functioning in terms of that power. And then there's also this desire of like, well, how do I, it wouldn't be like, I need to appease this so that I will be declared guiltless. I need to appease this power so that I can attain honor. You know, like that's not what's there. It's like literally oriented towards my survival and the benefit of my life, because that's what I'm most interested in preserving and pursuing. And so, yeah, but in there's a little bit of problem. I feel like there's a little bit of a problem organizing things purely in terms of the will, even though the majority of people probably are organized in that way. And you can see that it creates problems in Western society where, again, we talked about this earlier, but if you're saying the primary thing that you need to pursue is the intellect, and the majority of people don't, well, then you have created a lot of incentives for people to pretend like they are, even when they're not. And anytime you have a culture where there's a huge force where it's like, hey, a large number of you don't function this way, but you at least need to pretend like you do, or you're not going to be considered good people,
right?
Like, you know, solid people in the society, you're going to have all sorts of dysfunction, right? There's huge amounts of dysfunction in those kinds of environments. So that's one of the reasons I think in Western society, there is so much falseness, which is ironic considering we're supposed to be truth oriented and rational.
Yeah, we're false.
But we're, so much of us are very false. We're pretending because we're not allowed to operate according to the way we actually are.
Right.
And so we have to have all these pretenses and these masks that we wear. And, you know, and I know that there are masks and pretenses in all sorts of environments. I mean, Asian environments, you know, too. But I think actually there's less of that. Because again, if you're already a will-oriented person, and then somebody says, okay, well, you know, your will external, and here's some rules, and you need to live by those. And if you live by them, that'll be good. And if you reject them, you're a terrible person. Well, you're like, okay, I can do that. I want to do that. That's actually what I desire. Like, I actually desire somebody to tell me what's good. and what I should be doing and what's right, and let me do it. And you can see, I've thought a lot about like what is the individual person that represents each of these different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them do have like an ideal person,
mm-hmm.
right? They have mm-hmm. an ideal of like, and in the Old Testament, in the Bible, the places were actually named by their patriarchs,
mm-hmm.
right? So like Egypt is named Mitzrayim because Mitzrayim is the first father of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So Canaan is named Canaan because it is the children of Canaan that are there.
Right.
Right. And so it was almost like Canaan represents the ideal person of our society.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
I do, yeah.
So I think there is a sense of there's an individual idea of like, if the society should be shaped like this, it's because there's a sense in which the society represents our idea of a human being.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody's really trying to become that human being in that society, that ideal person that the image of the society has created or like is putting forward.
And then, I mean, that creates all kinds of problems because you've got people that are outcast then because they don't fit into that ideal.
Exactly.
And it's just a domino effect of,
or they're playing games. They pretend they can't really be who they really are in that particular society. And again, I'm saying if you create a society where intellect is first,
mm-hmm.
that you're going to have a false society because like the vast majority of your population, I don't care who they are not going to be intellect first.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means that they're all going to be playing these games, pretending to be something they're not.
Right.
And when it would be so much easier if you're just like, hey guys, you're just not that way.
It's okay.
And that's okay.
It's okay.
Like, don't worry about that. Stop trying to be something you're not. It's not a big deal.
Right.
Like, but the only way to do that is if you start believing that the ideal is a composite person,
mm-hmm.
right? So then you start saying, well, there is, the ideal is kind of a makeup of all the ways we contribute. So rather than you having to be the individual person that totally conforms to the ideal person, instead we just say, no, you're just part of the ideal person. Maybe you're a member of that body.
That would make it so much easier and take a lot of pressure off of a lot of people.
Exactly.
So we were to function in a different way and look at ourselves as more of a composite instead of ideal.
Right. And then you can say, okay, well then Krista, you're not the whole person and mm-hmm. you don't even have to be.
And I'm like, yay.
But just find something in the ideal person that mm-hmm. you can be
mm-hmm.
and you be that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're going to be for society.
This harkens back to the body of Christ.
It does. It does. So that's the reason why Paul talks about it in those terms.
Mm-hmm.
That like not everybody's an eye, not everybody's a mouth, not everybody's a nose, not everybody's a finger, not everybody's hair. We gotta fulfill all these various different parts in this composite that is the reality of human being.
Yes.
That human being is not a monistic, monad type of a reality. It is not a monolith. It is composite.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that society would function better if we're comfortable with that. And then people could be more comfortable saying, yeah, I don't do that. I don't do that in this body. I'm not an eye. I'm not a mouth. I'm not an ear. I'm not a whatever.
And
I'm
those be great. We have those boundaries and we're like, oh, we know what we can do. We're not expected to do the other mm-hmm. things. It's actually a very functional system.
It is. And it's freeing.
Mm-hmm.
And, I do think that the honor shame cultures tend to emphasize this more, where, I mean, think about the specialization that from ancient times
mm-hmm.
was expected within Japanese and Chinese culture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even, I don't know, have you seen the documentary Hiro Dreams of Sushi?
No, I haven't.
Well,
Dreams
about,
of Sushi? Like
yeah,
the
sushi.
Food? Sushi.
Yeah, the food.
Okay.
Yeah. It's about a dude whose life
it sounds
is
very
sushi.
Entertaining.
I know you'd think like this movie would not be interesting. It's a documentary too. It's not even like a drama.
I'll have to watch it.
It's a documentary of a guy whose life mm-hmm. is sushi.
Okay.
And he's the head of like one of these, you know, probably one of the more prominent like Tokyo sushi restaurants. But he's obsessed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually pretty common in Japan and in China that is like, okay, well, what do you do in this world? Well, I make sushi. That's all I do. Like, you know, but if there's the ideal Japanese person, you know, like the composite of our nation, the sushi making part of that is me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, that's what I
got you.
Yeah, I got you. I got you covered. Like, Japan will be fine if I'm the only person making sushi. If I'm in charge of that.
That's good.
But that's the way they did most things. And so there was this specialization where it's like, well, what part do you play in society? And if you don't fit yourself into the hierarchy and structures of society, then like that is shame. That is where the shame comes in.
See, in the young cultures today, there's such lostness. And we used to be a country of, you know, you had the farmer and you had the baker, you had the, you know, the meat, whatever.
The butcher.
The butcher, thank you. that one. I couldn't think of the name of it. My brain is not functioning. But, you know, and young people, a lot of young people today are just, they're kind of lost as far as like direction and sense of direction. I know that encompasses a lot more than that. But if we were more communal in helping people even discover some of that, their functionality, like that what they're good in, what they can actually thrive in, instead of pushing people all through like you have to go to college or whatever, you have to get a piece of paper that who knows what you're going to do with the piece of paper, but this looks good. You know, I think that's a part of the falseness too, is trying to push all of these people into things that they may not be, might not be their, you know, suiting. That might not be what they really need to be working in, or the area they need to be working in.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that there should be a lot more freedom for that. And with my own kids, we've tried, I mean, we've got at least one child who will go the college track. And I've told all of them, if you want to do one of the learned professions, so, you know, if you're going to be a doctor, you're just going to have to go to school. You're going to go a lot of school. There's no way around it. If you're going to be a lawyer, you know, same thing. Even if you're going to be a pastor, you're going to have to go, you have a college degree, generally speaking, go to seminary, et cetera. But if you want to be a plumber, or involved in one of the trades, which is perfectly honorable and great, you don't need to go to college to do that.
Right.
And you probably shouldn't waste your money or your time in college actually to do that. If you're pretty sure that's what you want to do a trade, figure out what that trade is, maybe get, you know, apprenticeship, learn how to do it, work with some people, make money while you're working.
Right.
You know, and save some money. And that's going to be a way better track for you.
Of course.
And so we've talked to all of our kids about that, and that's what we've decided that we're going to do. And a lot of them probably will go to college, and that's their choice if that's what you want to do. But we're still asking the question, why do you want to go to college? What are you trying to accomplish there? Mm-hmm. And can we keep focused on what that actually is, like, while you're there? You know, for some of them, it's more socialization and, you know, getting connections. And I'm not actually against that. But again, it's like, well, if that's what you're going for, then what kind of degree do you need to choose? Mm-hmm. What kind of college do we need to choose? We're not going to send you to a really expensive
Ivy
school.
League, no.
You're not going to go and get, you know, a huge student debt, you know, trying to go if all you're wanting is to get these connections in these social in this social environment, which I don't think is worthless. I think that there's worthwhile value in that. But again, it's like, well, it's not worthless, but it may not be worth going into life crippling debt to get it. So, so that's how we're kind of thinking through it. I think it's helpful.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that's a good closing on that question. So the last question is going to be, more around where you're talking about faith and the affections. And I liked what you said about how, when you're sharing the gospel with somebody, that it would be good if you knew a little bit about the affections and where their orientation is, because that will help you in being able to speak to them about the gospel. Can you share a little more about that?
Sure. I think, obviously, not everybody's the same. So most people who are going in are very good evangelists, or at least are viewed as good evangelists. I don't know how good they actually are, but that they're viewed as good evangelists usually are people who are some combination of will and intellect and who are able to give really good answers and shut people down, you know, that have opposition and objections and stuff like that. And that's kind of how we view evangelism. And there may be some value in that. I don't know. I it's dubious, okay? Dubious value as far as I can tell. Because I was even talking to, Colleen, our youngest sister, and she had been talking to somebody about faith, you know. She was like, and Colleen sitting here, and she's like, I'm sure I didn't give good answers. I mean, you were walking by, you were going to breakfast, and I was just like watching you walk by, Michael, and I was just like, oh man, I wish you would come over here and give better answers than I did. But then, you know, at the end of it, you know, in all of her meekness and humility and sweetness and kindness and love, this person that she was talking to, and maybe she didn't give the most intellectual answers. I have no idea. I wasn't there. But she gave enough of a good testimony and witness of Jesus that this guy like wants to go to church and wants to be part of the community and wants to, you know, so it's effective mm-hmm. in the sense of that is effective. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's effective is that Colleen operated in her strength, mm-hmm. which is like, I'm not going to try to be a award-winning apologist here. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to be interested in loving because that's what I do. Mm-hmm. And that was way more effective. And I even said I probably would have botched it.
Yep.
I probably would have gone in and said a bunch of stuff and made him feel really embarrassed, you know, and which has happened to me in the past. Yeah. And people just get upset with me and they're like, oh, you think you know everything? Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, no, I've come back. You know? anyway, and so, but with her, you know, disarming humor and, her willingness to be really unassuming and be like, I don't necessarily know all the answers to that, but I love Jesus and what you're saying sounds bad. You know what I mean? and that is very winsome, mm-hmm. I think. And there's nothing wrong with evangelizing in those terms. If you want to be a little more self-conscious, and I think even intellectuals and volitional people could be a little more self-conscious about this, especially if you're dealing with somebody who obviously puts affections first, intellectual arguments are not going to win them. And volitional arguments are not going to win them. Telling them that's wrong mm-hmm. is not going to win them. They're going to say, I don't care.
Right.
Like, I don't care that you think it's wrong. Right. Like, you're obviously a jerk. Mm-hmm. So, like, what does it matter to me? You've taken no interest in my life.
And why are you telling me what to do?
Exactly. Why are you trying to tell me what to do? Mm-hmm. And, oh, you think you're so smart, mm-hmm. right? Well, I'm sure there's other people who are way smarter than you who could give you an answer. And even if I haven't been able to give you an answer, turns out you're a jerk, so I don't care, you know?
Right.
And I see a lot of those kinds of apologists, and they, you know, they have these slam dunk gotcha type approaches. Mm-hmm. It's like, how many, you know, you're winning a lot of arguments, but how many souls are you winning?
Exactly.
In those terms, I would say if you're dealing with a person who is actually truth first, which you're probably not, but let's say you are, then you can give them reasonable, rational. I mean, I'm thinking of like C.S. Lewis, mm-hmm. who was obviously an intellectual and probably, you know, he and Tolkien had lots of conversations and Tolkien basically convinced him, argued him mm-hmm. to the faith mm-hmm. with just a really sound argument concerning the true myth.
Right.
Right. That was the thing that really first penetrated Lewis. And that makes sense as an intellectual that he would be susceptible to argument.
Sure.
But I mean, is C.S. Lewis the average? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, is Tolkien the average? Are these are we sitting here going, yeah, I know his name mm-hmm. thousands of miles away and after he even lived, I know his name because he was a real average, normal dude. Mm-hmm. You know, probably not. The average person is not convinced in that way. So let's say you're, you know, volitional person. Well, how are you going to be convinced? Well, you're going to be convinced because you've shown me a way of living, a way of choosing that seems to be more functional, more practical, to produce better results. And I'm about that mm-hmm. because as a volitional person, I want to see better results. But even then, am I going to recognize the better results if I'm currently feeling okay.
Right.
Because part of the problem is that, especially in our society of excess and comfort, the one thing about folly is that it can't survive in a crisis. But that means it can survive in non-crisis.
Tell me, when you say folly, what do you mean by that?
Well, just when you believe something or you're following something that isn't actually true, won't actually produce what you think, what you hope for it to produce.
Okay.
So, you know, if I have trust, for instance, in debt, like that my trust in my credit card or my debt or whatever works until it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So, like, if in the first stage of the use of my credit card, you come to me and you're like, "Hey, you know, the borrower is slave to the lender. Like, you're putting yourself in a real bad situation here." I'm going to be like, "No, I'm not. I just bought a new car. I didn't even have to work for it. You know, like, you're telling me that doesn't work? It's working, bro. It is working." Right? You're not going to start thinking, "Oh, you know, maybe that was foolish," until the chickens come home to roost. You know, the you have to start paying the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same case with sin, of any sin, any kind of sin, any kind of sinful life, any kind of whatever. You know, I mean, it's unfortunate, but it usually takes having to pay the consequences before you start going, "Hey, maybe that was the wrong way to live."
Mm.
So, volitionally speaking, it's hard, I think, to convince people, even if you have better laws, even if you have better rules, even if you have better habits, better disciplines, even better results. They might say, "Oh, well, that works for you, but that wouldn't work for me. Mm-hmm. I can't do that."
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that affectional evangelism is probably the center of evangelism from a biblical standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm looking at, you know, 1 Peter 3:15, which is usually trotted out by evangelists, where they say, you know, be always ready to give an account of the hope that you have within you, you know, and they usually leave out, when they quote those verses, they usually leave out that bit of it where he says, "To anyone who asks you," to anyone who asks you. That's a really important part of that verse, because who's asking? You know, I mean, if you got a bullhorn on the corner of the street and you're yelling to people, "Repent and believe or die," or whatever, no one's asking you and no one's listening.
Right.
If they are hearing you, they're annoyed with you.
Yes.
And they're not thinking, "Oh, the life and the goodness that you're presenting to us here is so beautiful, so wonderful." They're not thinking that. They're like, how can I get as far away from this person as quickly as possible? And can we maybe get a city injunction that this person never be able to do this again?
Yes.
So that's generally the case. And I'm not saying that God doesn't use those things.
Sure.
Okay. God can use the jawbone of an ass. He can do whatever he wants, but that doesn't mean the jawbone of the ass is the weapon of choice. You
right.
know, like, wow, we need to stock up on jawbones of the ass. No, it means God can do whatever he wants. But if you're saying, you know, "I want to actually choose the right method," you know, like, "I actually want to choose the method that's going to have the best possibility of really getting through to people," I would say the affectional method is the best choice, even for a volitional person. Because for a volitional person, there is a good that is being presented to them.
Yes.
Immediately in that moment, even if it's just connection, friendship, care, no one's going to deny that.
Right.
No one's going to be like, "Hey, will you please not care about me? Will you please not be interested in me as a person? Will you please not desire my benefit and my well-being? Don't bless me. Stop that." No one is going to say that. Like, it is immediately attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Colleen is a great evangelist. She might not have the best arguments, and she doesn't necessarily know how you should live, you know, like those things, but she loves people.
Mm-hmm.
And people feel that, the interest, the care, the love that's there from her. And they go, I like this,
mm-hmm.
you know, where does this come from?
Mm-hmm.
Where is this hope that you have for life? Tell me.
Mm-hmm.
And she tells them, "It's Jesus." And at that point they can't go, "Ugh," you know, it's like, well, they do, but they're like, "Man, I wish I hadn't asked you that."
But it is a reflection of God's delighting in us when mm-hmm. a person delights in you.
Absolutely.
And that is very attractive.
It is to everybody. Mm-hmm. Nobody is going to deny a good. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I believe that the scriptures, and I just had my episode 20 where I talked about this, but the scriptures direct us to good works in those terms, and that's why. Mm-hmm. Because nobody's going to deny good. So we're supposed to zealously pursue doing good to others because that's the goodness of God.
It is.
And when people experience that good, that generosity, that sharing in life, they go, oh, where is this coming from? How do I get more of this? And we tell them it's Jesus. But they're not going to ask. They're not going to ask if they feel like you're annoying.
Yep.
And lame and selfish and self-centered and think you have all the answers and think you know everything.
And going to tell them what to do and what they should be and shouldn't be doing and all of that.
Exactly.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
And not even that. I mean, it's not appealing. Mm-mm. Like, you don't want that. Nobody wants that.
No, people don't want it. Now, that doesn't mean God couldn't use it.
No.
I'm not saying he can't. But even to David, who was called a man after God's own heart, Nathan accommodated his rebuke mm-hmm. with a story.
Right.
Okay, so like even with David, his message had to be accommodated. If you have to accommodate your message with David to keep from the wrong results, I would imagine that accommodating your message with other people is sort of the norm.
Definitely.
And I feel like it's like, what's your purpose?
Yes.
What's your purpose? If you're going out to evangelize so you can feel better about yourself, well,
and
you know, who cares how you do it?
People that you've won.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then who cares how you do it? You don't care.
Right.
Doesn't matter. You're not going to change. Why would you change? Because you're still going out there and you're still getting your points, whatever those points may be. I don't really know. I don't think God's granting you any points. but if that's why you're doing it, you have your reward in full. So mm-hmm. two thumbs up. Yeah, it was one. Here, I'll give you two. Two whole thumbs. Okay. But if you are actually out there and your concern is, how do I benefit the people around me to the maximal amount? However that may be, like, how do I reach them? How do I love them? How do I do good for them? Then if you do something and it doesn't work, you're going to say, oh, well, I need to do something else.
Right.
And it may not be like, I need to do something else generally, because you don't care about general. You care about this person you're talking to right now. You care about the people that you're with at that moment. And so you're going to say, oh, you know, when I said that, oh, that offended you. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to offend you.
Right.
Like, I care about you. Maybe I need to talk less. You tell me what's going on. You know, why were you offended?
And just giving like the open door, like, we may disagree on issues.
Yeah.
We may disagree with whatever.
We probably will.
But let's have a conversation. Like, let's talk. I still care about you. Even if I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, I may not have all the points.
Yeah.
You know that.
But you have to really believe that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that's what's so great about the Colleen method is she really believes that.
Yeah.
She's not coming to you and be like, I may be wrong, but I don't think I am. She's like, no, I'm probably wrong.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And it's
having
great.
Having the humility to
it's
be
disarming.
Able to say that. Yes.
It's very disarming.
It is.
So anyway, all that to say that is something I think as Christians we should take more into account. The fact that we don't take that into account, I think just points to the fact that overall, we don't care about other people. So when other people say, hey, it doesn't seem like you care about me, I understand why you're saying that. It doesn't seem like we do.
That is the sad truth.
Yeah.
Those are facts.
Yeah. Maybe even truth.
And truth.
In the facts.
And the facts.
I don't know. I mean, there are exceptions. Like I said, I'm not trying to bash. It's funny. Like, a lot of people are like, so you're just not in the church. I'm like, no, I'm totally in the church. Mm-hmm. They're like, well, you act like the church is really messed up. I'm like, oh, it is.
And that's why I'm there.
I'm there. I'm part of that messed upness.
Yes.
A and B, I'm just trying to do the best I can, you know? And I think, I'm here to try to benefit my brothers and sisters and the people around me. So if God is going to use me in those ways, I need to be where the use would be useful.
So we need to figure out how to take this to the churches and how to bring awareness so that we can start granting more, so that we can become more unified in our different areas of strengths. And I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, I don't either, actually, because, well, I mean, there are all sorts of ways you could. I'm just saying that most of them are not effective.
Mm.
How bad do you want this to get? Like,
how bad? You mean depressed? You want me to get depressed?
How depressed do you want to be?
No, I don't want to be depressed. Let's just talk about Jesus.
Okay. So Jesus didn't have place or position or any kind of formal influence. And he wasn't a priest. He wasn't a king, you know, wasn't a ruler in those terms. Mm-hmm. He was.
But not.
Wasn't mm-hmm. in formal terms, in formal human terms. And he is now in formal human terms, which is really interesting. But in his lifetime, before his death, before his ascension, he was not anything formally or recognized as anything formally. And he had a terrible plan. I mean, his plan was just dumb, stupid plan. I mean, I'm serious. Like, if you were to take Jesus's plan and you were to give it to like a promotions expert or like a marketing expert and be like, hey, does this seem like a good plan? You know, let's say you have infinite resources,
mm-hmm.
right? Like no object, like there's money's no object, like nothing. Like I can spend as much, I have all of the cattle on the thousand hills. I got everything in the whole universe. I can do whatever I want. You know, here's my plan. as a marketing expert, I think everybody would say that's a bad plan.
Mm-hmm.
That is not a good plan. First off, why are you even coming to Earth? That seems like a bad plan. Taking on flesh, that seems like a bad plan. As a baby, that sounds like a bad plan. Among an unimportant people, that sounds like a bad plan. Among the most unimportant of those unimportant people, that's a bad plan. Without land, as refugees, horrible plan. You know what I'm saying? Like, are you ever going to gain access to the levers of power, either in the religious situation or the civil situation? No. You're going to make a lot of money? No. You're not even going to have a home. Okay. Well, your followers, though. We've got that. We've got your followers, right? And you could write books. You're not going to write books. Okay. Your followers could write books. Okay, we're back to the followers. All right. You just got to pick really good followers, like really important people, influencers, you know, like the cream of the cream, the classy guys. I mean, like the people that everybody's going to follow. Yeah, I picked tax collectors and outcasts and sinners and prostitutes and fishermen, illiterate people mostly, all of them poor, totally insignificant, a lot of sick people. That's about it. And they don't even get it. They're not going to get it. They're not going to get the message. They're all going to leave me and abandon me. I'm going to die as a criminal, naked on a cross. All right, that's my plan. Give me your feedback. What's your feedback on this plan? You know?
Sounds terrible.
It's a terrible plan. No, and it's important to understand, like, that was God's plan.
Yes.
That was God's plan. Like, that was God doing what he intended to do with infinite resources and infinite possibilities. Like, that's what's hard to understand sometimes. Like, this wasn't something that he was, like, cornered into. Like, he chose to do this. He could have chosen to do any number of various different things. But in his plan, he's like, okay, how to save the cosmos? This is his plan. This is what he decided to do. And it actually is the stupidest possible plan ever, ever, except for one very small, tiny little detail. It worked.
So he made something immensely beautiful out of everything that was broken.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. And it also means that we're looking at this situation and we're like, how do you get people convinced? And everybody's ideas of that are actually the stupid ideas, right? Get the important people and celebrities and the, mm-hmm. you know, the money makers and the movers and shakers. And, you know, those are the real important people. You got to capture their attention. You got to capture their interest. You know, put a lot of money into marketing and exposure, you know, just get it out there into the world. And, you know, the more important the person that you can make contact with, the better that is, you know, if you can get some big donors. Yeah. Okay. And, you know, talk to the leaders of these churches and, you know, not these small churches, like go to the mega churches. Mm-hmm. Like that's where you're really going to get the influence. Sure. And all of that sounds like good wisdom. It's not. It is folly. It doesn't work. God's plan actually did work. Jesus is, no question, the most important human being that has ever lived. No one disagrees with this.
Yes.
We divide the hemispheres of human history before and after his existence.
Yes.
When did he come to earth? That is how we divide all of time for all of human beings. I mean, just the idea that he actually successfully did become that important, centrally important, was such a poor plan for that. You know what I mean? Not very promising plan. And yet it worked. And so in that sense, I would say, you know, that God shames the mighty things with the weak things, and that he causes the wisdom of the wise to be proved foolish. And that, I think, goes all the way back to this too. Like if you, the reason the affections are dismissed is because they're weak. They don't, that doesn't seem like the way that things are going to get done.
Your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And yet, God chooses those things, those weak things of the world.
He does.
To shame. I mean, for instance, Jesus is the seed of the woman. So like all the power and the prestige and the fame and the money and the pleasure and the everything, you know, properties that Satan had, all the kingdoms of the world, you know, that he had built, or hadn't built, just stolen, whatever. You know, that kind of like malevolent, seemingly unstoppable power. And he really was overcome by a mother. It's true. He was overcome by a mother. And so that doesn't seem like that's the way it would go. But good does truly conquer evil in the end. And I don't mean this in terms of righteousness conquers wickedness. I mean, that's obvious. I'm saying life conquers death.
Mm-hmm.
Love is as strong as death. And life ultimately overcomes death. Resurrection is reality. It's not a pipe dream. It's the reality of the situation. And so in those terms, I think we can pursue love in our environments to our own cost. I know everybody talks about love like it's some silly little thing, but it costs a lot to love people. It costs a lot. It costs suffering. To love people consistently takes way more strength than to dominate people. Mm-hmm. It takes way more strength. When you're seeing Jesus on the cross, that's not a picture of weakness. That's a picture of divine strength.
Mm-hmm.
He's holding back the flood. So I feel like, you know, to consider love properly in the terms that God sees love, in the terms of God sees affections, in the terms that God sees these weak and silly things in the world, you've got to recognize, like, no, you're seeing them wrong. Like, you're not seeing them for what they really are. You're not seeing them for what they truly will be shown to be.
Mm-hmm.
And faith in that sense is seeing them now for what they are, even when they haven't been revealed. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like saying, oh, I don't need the king to wear his royal robes for me to recognize him as king. I still see his kingliness even when he's in beggar's garments.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's important because there's going to come a time when you're going to be judged on whether or not you saw the king in beggar's garments. And so if you're going to operate in faith, like, you need to not be operating according to status and influence and importance. Like, you need to be able to see the king when he's dressed in beggar's clothes. You see what I'm saying? Like, and oftentimes he is. That's the thing, is this is no joke. Like, again, this is not a fake thing. Like, when you start to see people for who they are, you don't see little beggarly people anymore. You start seeing that all these things that you used to neglect and used to think low and used to think useless and used to think stupid, there's great value in them and great power in them and great benefit. So, you know, and so you do see them for what they are, and eventually they'll be revealed. And if you don't see them now, you're going to be shown to be a fool then, which, you know, maybe that's okay. But I'm sure we're all,
I don't want to be that.
I'm sure we'll all be shown to be some kind of a fool. But Jesus did say, as you've done unto the least of these, my brothers, you have done unto me. And so Jesus is going around even now, dressed in lowly garments. I mean, he just is. So like, look for him. And I guess that's part of the whole thing with the three powers, is like, learn to value what God has said is valuable.
Yes.
Even if it's not in terms that you value already.
And I think that takes a work of the Holy Spirit in moving in that direction to even see those things. Like, the Spirit has to open my eyes to see the lowly, to actually be attuned to people, to learn and understand, to ask the right questions, to hear.
I have a question for you. So when Jesus is the least of these, like, what does that actually mean?
Well, I'm not the philosopher, but I'm going to speak on my terms of what I'm thinking. So I believe that what he's speaking of is the unseen people, the least of these, the outcast of the groups, the churches, the whatever is culturally popular. To give, for instance, and I actually spoke about this when I was speaking to the young kids that I spoke to about abortion and things like that and valuing life.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to them about what society values as important, like the athlete, and they discount the artists and the musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have seen the artists and musicians bullied by the bigger, you know, the group that's more acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's personal to me because it's happened in my own family, and it's hurtful, it's painful. And so my goal was to help to talk with, I want to see those people, and I want to see the people that are the least of these. And I think that the way that you see them is to look outside of what is that ideal, like we were talking about earlier, whatever cultural ideal is. But it's the homeless person. It's the transgender. It's the homosexual. It's the people that are considered by the church, we don't want to deal with you, like people with mental illness. I mean, there's a whole group of people that you can connect with in your own community that you find yourself, you know, every day. And so I believe that Jesus would be walking around and seeing those people, that people that aren't generally uplifted as, you know, the ideal.
Yeah, and I think he did do that.
He did do that. I'm saying that's
even today.
Even today.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think that's true. I think what's interesting is when Jesus is saying the least of these, I think he is framing it in your terms. Like, not your personal, but I'm saying in human terms. I think he's actually saying the people you think are the least. Because if it is true that your service to them was service to Jesus, actually, if that's actually a true statement, which Jesus says it, so I'm assuming it's probably true, then they aren't the least.
No, I
you know what I'm saying?
I,
yeah.
I understand what you're saying. It's so, based on your perspective.
On your perception.
Yeah.
Right. And I think what's cool is that, you know, it's so I don't think it's you go around and you're like, who's the least important, most worthless, terrible person around? I think, I mean, maybe do that and be like, can I love them? Can I show them love? The person that I think is the least. Because I think that's what he means. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think it, I don't think the point is like, you're supposed to show love to the person other people think are the least necessarily. I think that it is that you're supposed to love and find value in the people you think are the least.
But I don't think the people are,
do you think any people are the least?
I don't. I have to really sit and hit. I'm not trying to be like altruistic person or whatever, but.
All right.
But
I mean, you are really nice.
So. I want to see people. Like, I want to see that the person that I'm seeing faces, and I see faces of young people that are off and ostracized in the corner, and that are not the prettiest people, and they're, you know, I want to see those people. I want to help them to see that it is good that they exist, that's important to God. And I want them to feel that welcome, you know? So the least of these, I think for me, it is what everyone else terms as outcast or that might not reach out towards.
I think that's valid.
I have a friend that I was talking to you the other day, and she said, she was a young friend. She said, you know, I just get kind of scared if I go up. She had a transgender friend in her class or whatever. Mm. She's like, I just get scared because I don't have anything in common or whatever. And I get scared to talk to them. I'm like, well, they're a human being. Like, ask them about their school or, you know, what's going on in their life. Like, you can talk about anything. It doesn't, you don't have to worry about what topic. You can, just like you would walk up to any friend or whatever. But those are the kind of things that I think hurt my heart, that we are so exclusive and we get afraid to approach the unseen people because of, I guess it's just fear. I don't, there's lots of things that would be, but.
Well, I mean, there might be fear. It might be that we just don't see them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of times they're just not seen. Because again, it's like, why do we see people usually? Personal interest, personal benefit, you know. So it is the case that a lot of these people are unseen because they have very little utility in their particular communities as their communities are already organized. And nobody is willing to try and figure out how they could have benefit, value, et cetera, within that community. Or whether or not the community needs to have a different set of values altogether in order to receive the value of this person. You know, like a special category. That's a lot to ask. It is a lot to ask. But, you know, I mean, you've probably talked to parents who have Down syndrome kids or you know, and it's like when you're thinking, well, what utility in even our local community could a Down syndrome kid have? Well, in one set of metrics, not very much. Mm-hmm. Okay. There's a set of metrics that you could set up and you'd be like, this Down syndrome kid is probably not going to be like the most productive employee or, you know, make a lot of money or, you know, be a great tither. They may not, you know, there's all sorts of things you could say that like, if I'm looking for the quote unquote ideal church member or the ideal family member, the Down syndrome kid is not necessarily going to fit that bill very well. But if you've talked to parents of Down syndrome kids and just been like, so you wish you didn't have this kid who's only just a burden, they never say that. And I believe them.
I do too.
I believe them. All you have to do to believe them is spend any time with their kid.
Yes.
Because like a 99.99999% of my experiences with Down syndrome people has just been like wonderful, like life-giving, life-affirming.
I'm smiling right now because I have seen, and especially, have you seen the Peanut Butter Falcon? Did you see that movie?
I haven't seen it.
Oh my goodness. Is you good? Have to see it. Okay. It's so good. But it makes me smile. Just the pure joy and delight that they have. It's me happy.
It's wonderful.
It is.
It is a priceless treasure.
It is.
And so in those terms, you're like, who else has that?
Yeah.
Who else in your community has that?
Yeah.
And if you can't value that, get out of here. Yeah. Like, seriously, like, how can you not value that? And the parents are not sitting here struggling, trying to, you know. So anyway, I'm just saying there are lots of communities that out of a sense of inconvenience or utility or whatever, they are killing those children before they exist.
Yes.
Like, you know, Iceland or whatever was talking about how we don't even have any Down syndrome people at all because we abort all of them before they're even born. And you're just kind of like, what a loss.
Exactly.
What a loss for you all.
It's so sad.
And so anyway, I really do truly believe that that is the case, that these unseen, you know, these people who are like maybe don't have the same utility, just like set create a new category for them or try and figure out where they are valuable, because I can guarantee you they are. There's a reason they exist. God put them here for a reason.
I had an idea. I think that I had the people that I have a hard time going towards is the people that think that they deserve everything. Those are
entitled
people. Yes, the entitled people. That's the hardest one for me to reach out to, because I'm like,
that's actually what I was thinking earlier when I asked you that question. It's weird because when you start thinking about who are the people that I think, you know, man, I wish that they didn't exist. It's a totally different set. That's the least of these for me. Right.
Yeah.
What is difficult though, is that most of them are already doing just well. They're doing great.
Yeah.
They don't need anything. No. Anyway. So it's like, well, what would I do for them? I'm not really sure.
No.
I can give them the truth. I don't think they'll like it very much, but I'll keep trying to give it to them.
Yeah.
And in a way, I mean, you look at Jesus and Jesus's life, and he had these experiences with the Pharisees and with the hypocrites and whatnot. And they were, I mean, he would tell them things like, you have your reward in full, because like they didn't have anything to wait for. There's a theory that that a lot of the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection, because why would they?
Right.
Right. It's like, you have everything you want in life.
Right.
What are you looking forward to?
There's no eternal hope or eternal life to live.
Not even any need to. Like, if this life right here could just continue on forever, that would be fine with me. Mm-hmm. I don't need an afterlife in order for things to get resolved for me. Whereas on the other hand, I don't remember if I told you this, but I was reading, I can't even remember what the title of the book was called, but it was a book that was edited by Tabidi Anyabwali. You know what I'm talking about? Mm-mm. Okay, so he's a black pastor, and he had collected together writings from some early black pastors from
I know who you're talking about.
I think it's called like Faithful Preachers or Faithful something.
I haven't read it, but I know who you're talking about.
And so I read the book, and so I'm reading all these sermons from these black pastors like Samuel Lemke and Francis Grimke, I think, is another one that was in there. Anyway, so they have all these different sermons, and I started noticing that there was a huge emphasis on the Day of Judgment and most of these sermons. Like, they would come back to it. It was like a theme that they returned to a lot. I started noticing it as I'm reading through this book. And this is a book that, you know, has three different preachers, I think, or four different preachers, but it's spanning a good 100-150 years of time. But there's this theme of the Day of Judgment that keeps on popping up over and over again. I was like, you know, it's kind of weird. Like, I read a lot of sermons from other preachers, you know, white preachers and stuff from this time, but I haven't really read very much of such a hopeful and positive spin on the Day of Judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, and I think it's because a lot of people who are already satisfied in this life are not really looking forward to the Day of Judgment. But if you're a person who has suffered much, and has suffered much at the hands of the system as it's already organized, the Day of Judgment is actually a really great day to look forward to.
A day of rejoicing.
A day of rejoicing for you, not of fear, not of trepidation, but a day where like things will finally be made right.
Right.
And, you know, justice will finally be done. And that was just a strange thing to note in all, you know, in these texts. I read this a few years ago. But, and then on the other hand of things, you have these people who are satisfied, entitled, and have everything they want. What do they have to look forward to? Mm. Like the day, not only that, the day of judgment is not really a positive for them, because they're thinking when the day of judgment comes, it's probably not going to be good for me. Mm-mm. I mean, probably not. No. You know what I mean? If they ever, if they think about it at all,
yeah, which they probably, don't,
try to avoid. Yeah. But if they think about it at all. So I don't know. I think about, did Jesus, what did he do for those people? Were those the least of people for Jesus too?
But yet still some were converted, mm-hmm. and some came to believe. So we,
well, because he was also really faithful to do what he could for them as well.
Yeah.
I mean, meeting with Nicodemus at night.
Right.
What a shameful thing for Nicodemus to have forced him to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
But he was willing.
And he was willing.
Because that was and his sacrifice.
Exactly. Because mm-hmm. he was willing to do it mm-hmm. for Nicodemus. Whereas, you know, it's interesting that to this was so very bizarre mm-hmm. about all these things, that I've been thinking a whole lot about how willing God is to have a bad reputation.
Mm-hmm.
He's so willing to have a bad reputation. Not for the sake of, not for no purpose.
No, sure.
But I was just, I was listening to a podcast. I didn't like it very much.
was it truth telling for you?
No.
Oh, okay.
I love truth. Okay. I don't care. That, even in my
even
pain, I love it.
Even painful.
No, it was not true.
Oh.
I felt like they were bad-mouthing God, basically. They were talking about the book of Job, but they were bad-mouthing God in a way that, not like Job's friends, but more like Job, but they weren't understanding how Job was doing it.
Oh.
I'm explaining this very poorly. The thing about Job is Job said what was true about God, and it made God look bad. And God was willing to look bad. The book of Job is published. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
The book of Job is in the Bible, mm-hmm. which means that God is fine with just being like, okay, well, you know.
He can take it.
Yeah, I can take it because I know that if I put this book in the Bible... Mm-hmm. For however long, people are going to be reading this book and be like, wow, God's a real jerk. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you don't think he could have just, I don't know, not had it mm-hmm. in the Bible? Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, if God is who he really is, who I think he really is, then he knew that that's the way the book would be received. And he put it in the Bible anyway.
Anyway.
Yeah. And so people are going to read it. And he knew, you're like, yeah, you're going to read that. And we all think we're so sophisticated. Like you pull one over on God. I saw how things really were. I read that book, Job. Mm-hmm. It's like, you mean the book I put in the Bible?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm glad you read it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you didn't quite figure out. You didn't take that final step. You know what I mean? You took the step all the way up to the point of God's a real jerk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, no, the point you need to get to is the point where you realize God is okay with being viewed as a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
For your sake,
mm-hmm.
that like God is not going to say, I don't allow any bad mouthing of me of any kind. Job, and then the person Job and the book Job both indicate that God is okay with people speaking their mind about how they feel about what God's doing at any given moment. And I guess Jesus feels the same way because he goes to Nicodemus in the night. Even though it's really shameful, and maybe people don't understand, but like Nicodemus met with Jesus in the night because he didn't want to be seen. Nicodemus right. was a Pharisee, so he didn't want to be seen talking to Jesus because Jesus was persona non grata at that time. So Jesus could have just said, hey, man, meet me in the day
mm-hmm.
and give me honor due me.
Sure.
Or don't bother.
But he didn't.
But he didn't do that. It was like, I'm okay with the fact that people all think I'm something that I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm even okay with the fact that you are more concerned about your own reputation than you are with like showing me any honor.
Mm-hmm.
You're not worried about my reputation. You're just worried about your own. Anyway, but he still shows up and he still talks to Nicodemus. And as far as I can tell, Nicodemus believed. And so did Joseph of Arimathea, again, who was another member of the council. So there were those that did. And the reason they did is because Jesus was willing to be patient with them mm-hmm. and to tell them the truth, even though he knew they wouldn't like it.
Yeah. And I think that's, I mean, that is, should be something that we do as well. I mean, we're not going to throw pearls before swine, so to speak, but we have to be willing in whatever environment that we're put in, because we are in communities, we're in the place, we are in a place on purpose. So we, the least of these could mean different things to
different people.
Different people.
Yeah. And Jesus was willing to die for their chance to be saved.
Yeah. And it's not, it's easy for me, easier for me to see the least of these and to address the outcast.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as easy to address. And it's not that I don't see them. I see them. That's not it. It's just, it's harder for me to address in that way.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I'm just being totally vulnerable.
Yeah, me too. Like it, because they have hurt me a lot. And, you know, so.
And sometimes, and it's not just the hurt, that is true for me as well. But and I know you've experienced this, but the intellectual, what you have to meet a person in that mm-hmm. status, the intellectual, I don't have that intellectual capacity to be able to, I can say truthful things, but the version of truth that I'm met with, it's hard for me to like dissect it and like be like, no, that's not on what, I give up. And so, well,
yeah, but I mean, me too. Most frustrating conversations I've ever had in my entire life were with those people.
Well, so
yeah, so
we're on the same page.
And again, it's like my you know, whatever, quote unquote, superior intellect, it doesn't matter. Like the cool thing about power is that you don't care if you're wrong, that you don't have to. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. Throw this guy in prison. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like kick him out, hurt him. And then it's like, well, what does your truth matter now? You know? And so
that's so snarky. What does your truth matter now?
Yeah. I know, but it's true though. Like even Pontius Pilate is sitting here going, like, what is truth?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, who cares?
So like, the point is though, we need to lean into the people around us that we have connection, I mean, that we're in community with. And I think that would be an important thing for all of us,
yeah,
listeners. That,
and it is going to be hard. That's the point. That is hard.
Going to be
that
hard.
Is a hard thing. If you're like, actually, it's really easy for me to love the least of these. No. You're not loving the least of these, then.
Mm-mm.
It's not easy. That's Mm-mm. the whole point. But if you can learn to value them, you will grow.
Right.
Right. So, anyway. Somebody
doing the
spraying, I don't know, bug spray or something.
Fun anyway, times.
Thank you for the bug spray. I appreciate it.
Always fun.
All right. Okay. Is there anything else?
No, now? Except for I want to thank you for all of your hard work and effort and your experience and just what you've poured into this. And, I'm glad that I was somewhat a little bit of an inspiration to do all
the
of this.
The main soul inspiration.
There you go.
My mom's going to hear this and just be like, how dare you disown him?
Take away everything. No, but it's such a blessing. And I pray that many, many people will just be blessed by this. And it will cause them to live more like Jesus. That is our goal,
That's
is to
my
live
hope.
And love more like Jesus. So,
well, thank you. Thank you for coming on and being willing to talk to me and driving all this way from Kennesaw.
Yeah.
Is that, are you still in Kennesaw?
I am about to move to Ackworth, but oh, yes. Okay.
All right.
Not Ackworth. Too far. Ackworth.
All right. And thank you for coming all this way and being willing to talk to me. And apparently we're going to do at least one or two more of these, maybe.
Yep. We'll see. We'll have to I have to get my act together
and get through the rest of the three powers. So this is the, you know, parts one, two, three, or whatever of the three powers recap with my sister Krista Sliman.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost called you Krista Minkoff, but
it's okay.
You're Sliman now, which is really, you know, sly man.
I'm a sly woman.
Sly woman. Krista Sly Woman is here with us today.
We're just being silly.
So yeah, thank you so much for being here. And we'll see all of you, I guess, at some point. If you watch this video, we made a video and stuff, and I guess it's probably going to be on YouTube. I'll probably put it up there. So if you want to see us talking into the mics, then go on YouTube and you can see that.
And if you want to see me hitting the mic all the time.
Hitting the mic.
And making noises.
Yeah, you'll at least know where some of the noises are when like my elbow comes down on the table.
My
and
wrists
she has
jingling.
Her wrist bracelets.
Oh, yeah. Fun times.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, thank you all. We'll see you later. Until next time.
Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to join me October 8th at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time on my YouTube channel, which you can find at Nothing Human Podcast. It's just at Nothing Human Podcast. And I'm going to do my first live stream Q&A on that date, October 8th, 6:30 p.m. I'll be doing one of these live streams at that time, 6:30 p.m., every other Wednesday evening for the foreseeable future. So I hope you all will participate and bring your best questions. And if you have any comments or questions that you don't want to ask there, you can remember to navigate over to my website, nothinghumanpodcast.com, and you can leave me a note on the relevant episode. All right. So thank you all so much for listening. I'm sorry this has taken me so long to get this last bit out, but I appreciate your patience. Until next time.
Nothing human can be alien to me.
Nothing human. Nothing.